Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I'm sorry I didn't have a new show last week. As some of you may have heard, the Autonomous Metropolia has defrocked me, that is to say, removed me from the list of clergy, although it did not excommunicate me or anathematize me, nothing like that. It just was a removal from the list of the clergy, which of course I knew was going to happen. On my website, rustjournal.org, I have my response to it. The absurdity of the entire thing, the contradictions, the really gets to the point of this being comedy here. Nothing in my life is affected. I'm with another group now that I'm not ready to make public. And so the priesthood and everything else has not, in my case, has not been affected in the least. St. John Chrysostom says that for those who have been falsely deposed, they have a reward that is greater than any holy orders. He being, of course, deposed many times. What was the most curious of it all was the grounds upon which they justified this. When they initially summoned me to this, they didn't give me any canonical infractions that I had committed. Which is what you have to do. The canons are very clear. You have to send three summonses to me with the possibility of fixing problems before there's any trial. I only received one. And within the summons, there has to be a very specific reference to the canon being violated. And there was none. So right off the bat, this whole thing is illegitimate. But the canons that they use and justify it, that were in the verdict, actually, they belonged in the summons, not after the fact. Well, first of all, the canons that they used were ex post facto, but they were also almost randomly chosen. They had no relevance to anything that I'd been doing. The canons that they cited had more to do with taking in a secular office, being a businessman while being a clergyman, and insulting a bishop. Or slandering a bishop, I should say, which, of course, was not in the initial summons. Slander is something you have to prove. They simply say in the verdict that I slandered Bishop Joseph. Well, you have to prove that what I'm saying is false, and you have to prove that I had malice in my utterances, of course, which they didn't bother to do. I did not go for a whole bunch of reasons. I was given no procedural guidelines on how this is going to go. I asked for their arguments, the canons that I violated. We would call discovery requests today. That was all ignored. People who were going to be judging me, I knew nothing about them. I needed backgrounds for them in case there's any conflict of interest. There were no charges. A charge has to have a specific canon and the connection between what I've done and the canon. Nothing of the kind was done. No rules of evidence were sent to me. And plus the fact that I had sent them several letters, which I've published now on my website, answering all their problems and answering it in depth. These were all ignored. Every question I had for them, everything I wanted. So then I asked for a continuance, and that was denied. So finally, they answered a question of mine. So clearly, there's no legitimacy here. Clearly, no standard, even the minimal standard of legal fairness was included in this. All my questions were ignored. And it really was just it's just a shame. Now, I get offers to join other groups all the time. Bishops contact me, or representatives of bishops contact me and say that you're wasted with this tiny little group. And I always defended them. You know, just because they're small, it doesn't really mean anything. But it did bother me that they really don't do anything. There's no, publications or charity or anything like that. They have no activism. And if it wasn't for myself and Joseph Sweden, they would be totally invisible. They would have no web presence, even. So Even Orthodox traditionalists don't know that they exist. So at least, you know, the upside of all this is at least finally someone knows that they exist. And only because of this. But getting rid of your most active clergyman is probably not the best idea if you want to grow and develop. The only reason, as I've said before, the only reason behind it all was that I baptized Matthew Hunbeck. And that, that the way that it was put to me by the bishop over the phone was that he was somehow involved in the riot in Sacramento. Okay, I said to him, no, he wasn't. He didn't go. He wasn't there. This was simply a group of white people protesting illegal immigration at the state house in California, Sacramento being the state capital. And they were jumped by a group of communists and anarchists, as is normally the case. But even if he were there, number one, so what? Number two, they're on the right side of things. We shouldn't be worried about that. We should be congratulating. Number three, they're fighting. It's not like they're fighting, you know, ordinary people. They're fighting communists. They're fighting freaks of nature here. And number four, the good guys won. So I don't see really what any of this was trying to please. The argument ended up being that because I baptized Matthew Hunbeck and a riot took place in Sacramento where there were media reports falsely saying that the Traditionalist Workers' Party was there. They were not. That lack of participation and then the indirect connection of that riot to Matt Hunbeck and then Matt Hunbeck to me would look badly on the church. And I said, is that as good as you can do? There's a vague connection to a riot that we had nothing to do with? And I was told that it made us look bad. I said, it makes you look good. You should be taking credit for that rather than running from it. Who are you trying to please? So that was told to me over the phone more than once was the only reason that there was the trial existed, the only reason that any of this took place. The Metropolitan has said that to me over the phone, and I appreciated his candor. He was not in total control here, and I remain on good terms with him. So the whole thing really is extremely unpleasant. And the worst part is that all they needed to do was contact me and ask me about these things. And I would have been more than happy to explain it all to them. But they didn't bother to do that. So I've gone elsewhere. It's a shame. But, my relationships with anybody else in that little group was non-existent. It's really a shame when you're a priest in a synod where you have almost every member on Facebook blocked, largely because I had no sense of humor. And they took me very literally, and they're just kind of dumb. And I got tired of explaining things to them, so I eventually blocked them. And they're decent people. They just have no idea what they're doing. And I don't have any ill will to anybody. But the bishop also did admit to me that Bishop Joseph in Edmonton had held his church hostage, saying that he will leave the synod unless something is done about Matt Hunbeck and or me. Again, all he needed to do was contact me, and I would have explained it to him. And there's a very good reason why they didn't. So I'm not really sure what's going on. The Autonomous Metropolitan is a handful of house churches. Without much in common. There's no ethnic connection. There's no liturgical connection. There's no even ecclesiastical connection. We have modernists. We have traditionalists. We have people who don't even know who Auxentius, the Archbishop of Athens, even was. There seems to be no purpose other than to have a place where people who have nowhere else to go can go. Bishop Joseph of Edmonton has our largest parish, believe it or not, with, I think, something like 80 people. The second largest parish is Father Elias, a good friend of mine, who has 15 people. So that should give you some indication of the sin, which in and of itself is not really a problem. that, you know, the numbers don't really matter. But, you know, Hockne, for example, is also a small jurisdiction. I did not go to Hockne, just in case you were wondering. But Hockne is a small organization, even smaller than the Autonomous Metropolitan, I believe, and yet has a, you know, substantial publishing institution and translating institution, and has tremendous charity and summer camps for kids and all this stuff. And it really bothered me that you know, the size of the organization is not relevant. It's really how the organization is run from the inside. And so I leave the organization. I resigned the day before the trial. I had given a list of things I was willing to do to placate them, nothing too big. And I said, if this isn't acceptable, I resign as of this moment. It obviously was not, so I had resigned. So they technically trying somebody who was not a member of their synod. That didn't seem to bother them. So, and that was probably the best thing to do. I figured, well, Richard Nixon resigned rather than face impeachment. I knew that the fix was already in. They had no interest in what I had to say, especially since that I had covered every possible angle to all of these vague accusations over the last 2 months. I published them all online. I sent them to anyone who would listen, and I was ignored. So needless to say, this wasn't, I wasn't taking it very seriously. And what it came down to, what the public face of it, was that they were demanding that I accede to certain historical claims that I know were false. That, for example, you know, the Synod condemning Philetism in 1872, that this was legitimate. Now, the problem with that is so many of the bishops there, Fanar people there, were not really bishops. They were simoniacs, or people who had bought their sees. No one denies that. So to what extent this was real is anyone's guess. Plus the fact that the entire Orthodox world had condemned the Synod afterwards. And most of the Orthodox world maintained communion with the Bulgarian Exarchate after their excommunication. But it's no different. I mean, the Kolevandis fathers were excommunicated in 1776. They had to leave Mount Athos, but otherwise they ignored it. And they continued to serve and do what they had always done. Saint Tikhon, the Patriarch of Moscow, was deposed, I believe it was 1925, for being involved in politics, being involved in secular cares, which is, by the way, one of the things that they ex post facto accused me of. And that, from the Renovationist Synod in Russia, was accepted by the Patriarch of Constantinople for some time. And of course, you know, the Soviet Church was recognized by all the major Orthodox churches of the world. So as actual Orthodox people are in prison and dying in the gulags, Stalin's church is clinking glasses at cocktail parties with the rest in world Orthodoxy. It's very hard to think of that in any other way but contempt. So that's really what it comes down to. I was supposed to deny these facts. I was supposed to say, no, it was quite legitimate. None of these people had bought their seats. I was supposed to say that in the writings of Bulatovich and others, they actually believe that the name of God is God in the literal sense, but the name written down is God, as God is present in the Eucharist, for example. I said, I know that's not true. I've already sent you a whole bunch of citations from them where they deny that. Well, I was supposed to recant all that. I said, well, I can't recant something that's true. And by the way, you haven't given me a single reason or a single piece of evidence what I'm saying is wrong. Ultimately, it makes them look terrible, and it makes me look very good. Again, I kind of feel sorry for them. You know, St. John Chrysostom says that I should be very, very happy. And obviously false deposition is something that is, you know, almost ensures your salvation. And so it doesn't bother me. I needed to go anyway. I had been contemplating leaving for many years. Ever since the irresponsible attack on Metropolitan Raphael led to the breakup of that very large church. I mentioned this before. Ever since then, I really was worried. And everything I had mentioned was either ignored or I got some, you know, non-answer. And so it was time to leave. So I leave with absolutely no personal animus whatsoever, and I wish them the best, and I wish them great growth, because there are good people there. Metropolitan John is a good man and a very holy man, but he clearly is not in control of things. And his health failing over the last year or so bothers me, but typical in the church that people just take advantage of that. I don't even know who it is taking advantage of that, but I know it's happening. So I wish them the best, and I'm not going to write or say anything more about it. I have my answers to everything on the site, an interview in the Daily Traditionalist that I did last week on it, and then this comment right here, and this will be the end of it. And then when everything is settled with the other group, I'll make it public who it is, and then this will eventually blow over, and I'll do what I normally do and just roll my eyes until I get a cramp in my face dealing with the absurdities here. Speaking of absurdity, the last show I did began to touch on the issues of the Russian symbolists. This is a literary movement that I got into about 10 years ago. And it can be typified in many ways. It's an extremely complex movement. You can't just be a literary critic to understand it, because these men were both poets and novelists as well as philosophers. It is the rebirth of Plato in Russia, although some of these guys are not Christians in any normal sense of the word. In fact, their religious background is very, very hard to discern. Now, a lot of these guys, even people like Agapius and others, converted after the revolution, and they became part of the catacomb church. The roles of the catacomb church, the underground church in Russia after the revolution, contain a lot of very surprising names. A lot of people who had supported the revolutionary movement, who were then destroyed by the Bolsheviks, began seeing how good old Russia was by comparison, and they converted. Of course, refusing any connection with the Soviet-sponsored church, which is a contradiction in terms, they went the only place, either in exile or the other option was to go underground. And I've mentioned this before. And Vladimir Moss has an excellent, a multi-volume work on them on his website. This underground church numbered the millions. It was the Orthodox Church of Russia, not the Patriarchate in Moscow, sponsored by Stalin. But in terms of Russia itself, within Russia at the time, during the Cold War, this was the Russian Orthodox Church, and it was extremely large. Given the nature of things, they didn't have much of an organization. But that doesn't matter. Organization is very unimportant in the Orthodox mind. And I should note, some of you may not know this, but the very early on, the underground church withdrew all of the anathemas against the old believer. So nothing in the old believer life, and this was done by even the Soviet church in 1971. I also don't want you to think that there was no good that came out of the Soviet church. There was. Metropolitan John of St. Petersburg, for example, is an excellent example. Wherever you find holiness, wherever you find, and holiness, by the way, is not bourgeois goodness. They're two very different things. Wherever you find holiness and correct doctrine, you find the church. God doesn't care much about jurisdictions. Jurisdictions are the creation of mankind, and the creation of man, very, very flawed creation, for the sake of convenience, and frankly, they're not very convenient. There's always been this tendency, especially for Western converts, to believe that bishops are the church in the same sense that the Pope is a church in the Roman world. And they're not. A bishop is an equal to any member. He just has a specific job concerning the clergy and the money of the diocese. But even there, the bishop really is nothing more than the spokesman for the diocesan synod. It's always collective. So even there, the concept of the bishop that is the dominant, the tyrant of the diocese, that is a fairly new development. We've always understood that there was a diocesan synod that made decisions, and the bishop then would, using a plural, referring to himself as we, would make that decision proper. He, of course, the buck stopped there. So the bishop did have that power, but he had, the bishop is wrong. He can be criticized. He can be deposed. You could get rid of him. or there's nothing special about the guy. He was elected by, at one time anyway, elected by the people and the product of the monastery. It's very important to notice, when you read books about the old calendarist movement, for example, in the 20th century, and the only thing they refer to is bishops. A synod did this, the bishop said that, and what are the people saying? What are the priests saying? What are the, these are equally a member of the church as the bishop is. The bishop is not, does not collect the church in his person. Or if he does, it's understood as a collective body, not as one individual. And that's forgotten. This is why the old believers, old believer bishops don't have much power. It's understood that bishops have relative power, and that's it. The most they could do is point us to where grace is. One of the great symbolists, though, and again, moving to something like the, my trial, to symbolists makes a lot of sense, because absurdity is their central motif. And my favorite symbolist is Sologub. And he is by far the most bizarre. He just dabbled in every esoteric vision you can without committing himself to any. Ultimately, he was not one. He was not one of these followers of the Arcana. He didn't believe that. But he did, in the process, did accept Plato as really the man who had the solution to the problems of Russian society. The symbolists in general were the result of Plato, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche, with a strong dose of the Orthodox tradition. Maybe if they were to form something, this is what they were. This is what they created. This is not an Orthodox movement. Although many of them converted, there's a lot of things here that Orthodox people can use that are useful. It's not an Orthodox movement. However, I think it's much healthier than a lot of the intellectual movements of the time. Sologub is known for, I guess his most famous work is The Petty Demon. And it's petty, not little. It's a qualitative, not a quantitative term. Bad Dreams, The Created Legend, and my favorite, Light and Shadows, The White Dog, The Old House, The White Mother. And then he turned The Petty Demon into a play in 1909. And these are, but the topics, the plot, the characters are far less important. And really, these plots are uninteresting. Typical for philosophical writers, the plots are, I could take them or leave them, and they're not, they make terrible movies. The plots are just an excuse to introduce characters. The characters, really, just excuses to introduce philosophical concepts. The idea being that expository prose is not the best way to describe something. Expository prose doesn't really convince anybody of anything. But when you put it in a daily, give it a daily, humdrum scene and act it out, it has greater impact. Sologub's whole vision is that modernity, the bourgeois life, urban life, is just a theater of the absurd. The greatest evil is what modernity always promotes, and that is mechanism. The idea that everything is a machine, you have your place in the machine, your body is a machine, your brain is a computer, and society is one big anthill. And he sees that everywhere. I see that everywhere. And the fact is, and what bothers him, is that most people are quite happy with that. They're quite happy with that, as the existentialists would say, because it relieves them of responsibility. You don't have to be anything great if you're nothing more than a cog in a machine. It's very comforting for people. However, it comes at a price, and that price is a bad conscience. Now, I've known people, I was married to someone who was a cog in a machine and had trained herself not to question that. In fact, questioning it led to very strange responses. There is nothing more dangerous, and you see this in all of Sologub's work, in existentialists as well. There is nothing more dangerous than dealing with someone who is deluded in that respect, and then poking holes in their self-image. You do that, you better run. Someone who believes that everything is healthy, that the machine is perfectly acceptable and this is what we really are, you confront these people, you tell them that it's not true and that your satisfaction is based on your own lack of insight and thought, it's all true, you better duck, because you will not get a rational response. That suggests to me that deep down they know that they're wrong, but there's nothing they can do about it, and therefore they have learned, they've trained themselves to repress, and they've trained themselves to repress any critical thought. And often, since they're rewarded for this, it just gets reinforced over time. The other theme in Sologub is the little man. Now, this is throughout Russian writing. The modern world has created these colossal institutions, powerful states like the world has never seen, powerful machines the world has never seen, powerful armies and surveillance systems that the world has never even dreamed of prior to the modern world. No one has even been able to conceive that states have more power now than they ever have. You can't have a totalitarian state before the 20th century. The surveillance technology didn't exist, therefore couldn't have existed, only in modernity. And what it creates is, well, when you have that system and then you stress the individual, which is, you know, insult added to injury, the individual, this isolated monad, this isolated atom, saying that he is the whole purpose of everything, and he realizes that he has absolutely no power. The little man, the superfluous man. The little man has a few choices. Number one, he could be in bad faith and accept his fate and simply live as a cog in a machine, have no purpose, have no real thought. Number two, he can go to war against the machine. The problem is that he's just a person. He's going to have to limit his ego and join a community if he's ever going to fight the system. But the system itself says that that's a problem, so they don't do it. So it's just a desperate scream against the system with no real benefit. Number three, they could alter the way they think and become a part of an alternative world, ideologically or religiously or otherwise, slowly but surely delegitimize the system. But that requires humility. That's obviously the most rational way to go, but it requires you to limit your, we just have to tolerate the flaws in other people. And in that respect, you know, people on the right wing, you know, learn from each other, stop worrying about names or labels, stop calling names. You know, I can get the good out of pretty much anybody out there now. I mean, genuine, you know, paleos, nationalists, whatever you want to call them, we need to cooperate. Stop hating each other. We don't agree on every little thing. But even as individuals, we don't agree on every little thing. I've changed my mind a bunch of times on different things. We don't even agree with ourselves. We're all flawed people. Anyway, but the little man syndrome is to be found there. The concept of this mass man who doesn't have a place, who doesn't have a purpose, who doesn't have a function, who is dictated to, is absolutely convinced that he's free and yet knows that he's not. And that dissonance drives him insane. This is a huge concern of the symbolist. The average person, and I'm stressing the word average, but the average person thinks that he knows, or even what he perceives, is completely false. It's a projection of the system. It's a projection of his own frustration or of his own ego. None of it is real. A dream that we have, even while sleeping, has more reality than what the average person thinks that he knows and what he perceives. Convention, routine, this isn't created by you. This is created by a highly degenerate elite world who requires it for your own docility. It's to be despised. There's nothing healthy about it whatsoever. The real and the unreal, or the phenomenal, not respectively, the phenomenal and the noumenal, really the noumenal, the Platonic form, to use Kant in a weird way, is the only reality. But someone who lives in the realm of the noumenal today will be sent to a lunatic asylum. Because if you were to do that, you're essentially telling people that the world around them, what you think you see, isn't really there. What you think you hear isn't really there. These individual objects are the result of language and conditioning. The machine speaks in platitudes and cliches without really thinking about it. In fact, Solo Group defines hell as the eternal platitude, which I happen to agree with him on. The world for him is living, breathing mediocrity. It's bureaucratic. It's fragmented. It exists for the benefit of others, and that degenerate elite, even they, don't benefit from it. Because the money and power that they receive doesn't satisfy anybody. The truth of the symbolist has to confront the projections of the mass man. Objectification, organization. This is what happens when someone grows up. You go through the horror of puberty. You're put into a cubbyhole, some identity that's given to you. And the innocence and the freedom of children, of childhood, is gone. This is why these symbolists love children. And the most horrible aspect of symbolist writing is that they often speak about innocence being violently taken from children. Adults, and I've always thought that child abuse is a resentment. An adult looks at a child and sees Eden, sees happiness, sees freedom, a world that he would love to live in but can't because he's an adult. And he takes out his frustration on the child. Having two children I'm very close to, it's very difficult for me to read these things without getting upset. I know precisely what they're talking about, and I'm extremely sensitive to it. Puberty is a horrible thing. It is a recapitulation of the fall of man. This is one of my big things. It is recapitulation in almost every single respect to the fall of man that you'll find in Genesis. It is usually very unhappy. I believe the only people who really get through it are very attractive women, girls, I should say, or boys that are very distinguished, like in sports, for example. They do pretty well. Otherwise, it's absolutely miserable. Attractive women do extremely well because even at an early age, I think, good-looking girls realize that they can use their figures, they could use their face to get men or boys to do things for them. And I think, you know, I even observed that very early on. They know slowly but surely they come to understand the extent of the power that they have. So the innocence is gone in that regard as well. They start seeing men, other boys, as objects rather than as equals, that they can use their appearance to manipulate others. Women have immense power in this society. It is a gynocracy. I've always said this, but one of the most powerful and just ridiculously unfair forces, that coercive elements that a woman has over a man, is self-esteem. All men, myself included, have fallen for this before. That when a beautiful woman loves you, likes you, wants to be with you, your self-esteem goes through the roof. This is part of what makes it so euphoric. On the other hand, the opposite occurs. If she doesn't, your self-esteem goes into the toilet. I have seen when I was in high school, the toughest kid on the football team, Jeb was his name, was rejected by his girlfriend a long time, very, very beautiful. Everyone wanted her. And I watched this kid. I felt bad for him. I watched this kid just outside of the locker room where I went to high school absolutely collapse. He went to his knees, begging her not to leave, not to break up with him, go off to someone else. This is a kid that was All-State on the football team, tough guy. I must have been a sophomore when he was a senior. And I watched him collapse. Completely collapsed in on himself. The toughest guy in school, because of a woman, has been completely defeated. The guy was on his knees, tears streaming down his face. And she didn't seem to show any empathy whatsoever. That was a very, very strong lesson for me. It's nothing but appearance, by the way. It's not real. It's that we've been trained to recognize a certain standard of beauty, and she's been put in that category through makeup or, you know, whatever she did, and only hung out with others like her. So clearly they form a tribe. But when I saw this guy, the toughest kid in school and toughest kid I've ever met, actually, completely, and he didn't care that it was in front of everybody. You know, there were 30 people there, at least 30 people there, and everyone was watching. He didn't care. It was like someone had taken over in his psyche. This is the power that women have. So moving from childhood through puberty, this is just one of the methods that the modern world, or the world in general, has used to destroy people. It's just an image. There's nothing special about these women other than their appearance. In fact, their appearance has prevented them from, they don't see any need to become intelligent or to become knowledgeable. Why? I get everything I want just by existing. Showing a small bit of favor is enough to get money and cars and even in one case that I know of, an education. This is extremely important to the symbolists in general, the power that these images have. Now, was it that he was truly in love with this girl at, 17? Or was it that he thought that his position as, a football hero required him to have someone like that? And if he didn't, maybe he really wasn't the football hero that he thought he was, despite the evidence. That image, I can still picture that guy. Never left me. The power that they had. And the power was over his self-esteem to the point where he was willing to do that in front of practically the entire school. And it didn't care. He didn't care if it was in public. He had just, like another person had taken over. But this is the nature of the world. These images, this irresponsible power is everywhere. But the idea of puberty in the symbolists is everywhere. Children are not susceptible to that kind of thing. Children are free. Children are happy. They're not pigeonholed into a specific set of functions yet. This is why children pick up on languages so quickly. For adults, our language, our way of thought centers around who we are, the job that we have, and other roles that we have. We've been pigeonholed already. It becomes very difficult to get out of that and master a totally different vocabulary. For kids, they don't have that yet. They're far freer than we are. They don't associate words with functions, and therefore it's much easier for them to absorb. I've said before on this show, numerous philosophers over the years, that stupidity can be a strategic choice. Stupidity or ignorance can make your life much easier. The more intellect that you have, the more intelligence that you have mastered, the more difficult your life is. The reason is because someone who is ignorant can conform themselves to the mechanism of life, be in bad faith, without really knowing it, without being able to question too deeply, in which case they think that the system is perfectly acceptable and it's not a big problem. Those who have developed intellects can't do that. We simply aren't allowed. We find ourselves in these positions, and we know how rotten it is, how wrong it is, how unnatural it is. So we are far less happy. And there are times, you see this in the work of Solo Group, even my personal life, that I wish I could be like these people. I wish I could believe my ex-father-in-law was like this. Complete, utter, total conformist. He was in the military and was, retired at the average lieutenant colonel level. He was a potato peeler, essentially. But the point being, you couldn't really function in that role unless you were like that. You couldn't function in society and be happy unless you either were ignorant from birth, upbringing, or that you've made a choice to be ignorant. And I don't blame people. I can't do it, which is a shame. I mean, those people are far happier than I am because they simply accept everything that comes to them as normal. They know no other way, no other lifestyle. This is all it is. This is how it is. And so it doesn't really bother them. There is no alternative. So being stupid, being ignorant, is a lifestyle choice, so to speak. Reality is delusion for this reason. Those who are successful in this system are not intelligent or knowledgeable. They're devious. They've learned how to manipulate the shadows in the wall. Sologub's famous short story, Lights and Shadows, takes place in one home, and just people, mother and son, making shapes with their fingers such that it's then projected as a shadow on the wall. Over time, they become completely obsessed with this. And this is all they do. This is the only reality that they see. And the thing is that while they're doing it, they're happy. Now, needless to say, this is a clear reference to Plato's Doctrine of the Cave, where the powerful, in his mind, you know, the sophists and those who finance them, cast these images on the wall in front of them. They are chained such that they look forward. Now, Plato mentions that very intelligent people have come up with all kinds of theories and sciences in understanding these shadows. So it's not just for idiots. They're very, very intelligent, knowledgeable people who enjoy their position. None of these people seem to know that they're chained. They just say this is just how it is. There is no other option. That's just what a human life is. And there's nothing said about these people being unhappy. In fact, those who somehow are able to liberate themselves, go to the sunlight, make sure that they could, you know, it takes some time to be able to view it without pain. And then, of course, they have to go back down into the cave. Those people are miserable. Those people will be killed. This is why Christ was murdered. This is why Socrates was murdered. This goes on and on. Getting out and seeing the light, first of all, is painful. You've been in a cave your whole life. You come out and the sun is shining on you for the first time. Your eyes will hurt. We all know what this means. It's extremely unpleasant to learn about the situation of the world, who really runs it and why, what motivates people. It's horrible. Sometimes I wish I never discovered it. My life would be probably much more lucrative and much happier. I think we all are in that position. I often ask myself, if things were normal in the world, what would I be doing right now? Certainly not this. I probably have taken over my father's funeral home or been a jazz musician or something like that. But I would only have done that if I were still in the cave. I said this other word in terms of my own biography, how I broke out of it. But there's nothing pleasant about it. There's nothing pleasant about trying to adapt yourself to the sunlight. No one likes to find this stuff out. So many times, my predictions have come true. For example, the American, not only support for ISIS, but creating it. I said that from day one. My readers and listeners know this. From the very first day I ever heard of them, only now you see American USAF supporting ISIS position and on the verge of declaring war on Russia so as to defend ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria against Assad. There's nothing pleasurable in being proven right here. In fact, I'm so sick and tired of being right, I can't stand it. And there's nothing, you know, predicting the future is not very hard if you have broken out of the cave. Predicting the future is just to understand that most people are cogs in a machine, especially when the system as a whole celebrates being cogs in a machine. Or those, you know, they wouldn't put it that way, but that's what they mean. Once you understand that, you understand that without any kind of extraneous detail, you understand the essence of the matter. But to know that, you have to have broken out of the cave. With that knowledge, you can predict people with a great degree of accuracy and predict events. It doesn't mean you're a particular genius. It just means that you have acculturated yourself to the sun. But it doesn't end there. Plato is very clear. You have to go back into the cave. That means you have to do what the prophets of the Old Testament did. Jeremiah and Amos and Joel, all these people had to go in front of the assembly in Judah and say, the way you're living is wrong. This is not what Yahweh had demanded of you. You don't know the difference between Yahweh and Baal anymore. You're worshiping idols. You think it's Yahweh, but it's not. You're really worshiping your own ego and money. And God is going to create a threat, such as, you know, Assyria or Babylon. And they're going to come here and they're going to conquer you and send you off into slavery. I'm here to say that you deserve it. And I'm on their side. So this has something to do with why they were all killed. But that's no different than what any of us has to do. This is what the symbolist has to do in all of the great works. Now, light and shadow has more to do with the fact that these people now are, they're going to die there. Anything in their lives will fall apart because what they really love, and this, by the way, is before the invention of television, but what they love is the shadows that they're able to create. And as they get better and better, as they get older, they can make the most sophisticated shapes and things. And they're absolutely in love with the fact that they can do this. It's somewhat crude to have it like this, the story like this, but it makes it very clear and even more profound, especially before the invention of television. It's not uncommon to have the symbolist connected to Sologub connected to Schopenhauer. Only recently have I gotten back into Schopenhauer, The World as Will and Representation. And I realize the connections. The will is the fundamental world concept. You don't justify it because it is justification. The will creates the intellect. The will creates the entire world around you. It is identical to the symbolist position that what you think you see is a projection. It's a projection coming from you, but you are not just an isolated individual. You are the product of conditioning. What you see is not real. What you see is completely false. It serves the agenda of someone else. Even separating one object from another, depending on the circumstances, isn't true. Nominalism says that there is no real connection, one object to another. There's no real natural connection for one anything to another. One of the great attacks on nominalism was Nikolai Lossky's notion that an individual is not really an individual. Any individual object is, in fact, a complex of smaller objects. And you can get smaller and smaller and smaller. The individual is as much a creation of society as anything else. Our own consciousness. You can't refer to me as an individual, really, because I'm speaking a language I didn't make, ideas I didn't create, reading authors I didn't write, I didn't invent. Speaking to a microphone I didn't design. Everything, in fact, around me is somebody else's. So what right do I have to even refer to myself as an individual? And this goes to any object. We perceive it as an individual because it's necessary, because it's useful for us to do that. The individual object, in reality, well, on the one hand, it's separated from its context. A computer monitor, just by itself, is meaningless. It can't do anything. It has to be plugged into something. Something has to happen on it. By itself, it's absolutely absurd. It's like taking one lung and treating it as just a single object. It's not. We understand a computer monitor only when it's part of a system. And not just a system. It has to be powered. And it has to be a part of a society that understands what it is and has use for it. If there's an entire historical mentality that is put into any object. The history that goes into the computer monitor is tremendous. You have to go back to the Industrial Revolution, if not before, to make sense out of it. So there has to be a whole context of meaning for there to be even a simple individual like that. So that means it's all mythology. Nominalism is false. We have to start speaking of wholes, the all. Now, Schopenhauer vaguely deals with that, except just to say that the will is the primordial element. What we perceive, what we have, how we interpret what we perceive is a matter of the will. What Schopenhauer says about fame and reputation, though, was taken by the symbolists and used blatantly. For him, the concept of reputation, fame, it comes from the vulgar herd. Who cares? You know, it's like being a pop star. You know, they'll forget about you tomorrow. It's of no importance. But why should we be worried about it? That comes from our own pride. It will not make us happy. The people who decide to give us a positive review, good reputation, are people who otherwise we wouldn't care about. We aren't that important. The concept of pride is the saying that I am very important, but people don't recognize it. Vanity is when we spend time convincing others how important we are. We seek the socially useful, and yet we know that that means we have to be part of a machine. To be socially useful means we have to appeal to the very masses that we can't stand, that we have nothing in common with. We live in a society where, you know, those like me are struggling financially because so many of us don't have anything that the market wants, thank God. And we're quite proud of that fact because the market is lowest common denominator. Really, the market is a creation of corporate capital. They're not responding to anything, they're creating it. Both Schopenhauer and Solowyn, really the whole symbolist movement, deals with this cognitive dissonance where we want to be successful in a financial sense. We want to have money, we want to have people admire us. And in fact, we need that money to function. The dissonance comes in when we realize that that just forces us to be a part of a society that we hate, to have the approbation of people we dislike or don't respect, to become a part of this mass. So we look at others that have far more money than we do, but are far inferior intellectually. This is a permanent struggle with me personally, and I'm seeing it everywhere. And then I realize that it's not just a coincidence. They do better because they are less knowledgeable, and therefore they ask fewer questions. So then clearly the conclusion suggests itself. Being mediocre is rewarded beyond belief. If you're incompetent, you can't be useful, so you're not gonna work. If you're above mediocre, you ask too many questions, you can't be ordered around, and so you become a problem. The mediocre, therefore, are rewarded. They're the ones who are going to get the appointments, the money, the prestige. So on the one hand, we want to have that. Everybody does. But on the other hand, we know what we have to do to get it. And so we end up saying that we simply have to suffer. But that clearly isn't much of a solution. And this is why Schopenhauer stresses the idea of solitude. Even Nietzsche did the same. Only the ignorant really needs a crowd. You know, I see these concerts, you know, and people are doing just what the front man is asking them to do. They function. They seem to really revel in functioning as a mass. They used to do the wave at football games. I could never do that. I could never perform the actions that a singer is asking his audience to do. It was so beneath me. Talk shows that I've been on, people, they function like something out of Pavlov. And they enjoy themselves, which means that either they can't question it, or they simply don't, that they've learned how to repress. I've dealt with many people who I know are intelligent, but they realize, you take a professor out, I've done this many times, to the point actually where the University of Nebraska, where I got my doctoral degree, banned professors going out with grad students. Because when I was there, I would go out with professors all the time, just as friends. And after a couple of shots, they're telling me that they don't believe any of this stuff, that they're not really this liberal postmodern crap. They're just, you know, it's just a great gig. And how really is, and how many women I've had, students I've had, and you know, that's really what makes this great. After a few shots, is what they're saying. And this is the case here that, you know, people who are intelligent and yet successful have to repress that element. They have to learn to live with the fact that they know it's wrong. And for a professor, for example, it's very easy to do because the perks are so tremendous. Now, having been out socially with a number of professors, you know, it just really takes, depending on who you're with, 2-3 shots and that's it. They're telling you their whole life is a sham. And this became a bit of a scandal on campus in the 90s when I was there. And university provost banned the practice. I don't know if that was a reason. But clearly that was something that was on their minds. And I've done this many times in the past. So it isn't just a matter of this being too dumb to understand or not caring. But also those who are intelligent enough to question, but they can't. The gig is simply too good. And it's hard to judge those kinds of people. They're not bad people, but they're supporting a rotten system. The point is, in Schopenhauer and the Symbolists, the human will, the human desire, creates everything. And this really means it's a kind of a Promethean idea, a Luciferian idea that reality is constructed in the interest of the powerful. What we see isn't really there. If we had a completely different set of desires, it wouldn't be visible to us. We wouldn't see it in that kind of a way. That reality is structured according to the zeitgeist of the air itself. And seeing things, a businessman will not see a forest, a businessman will see profit. You know, if I cut this down, if I put a parking lot here, if I something like that, he is not seeing the same object that we are. It's being filtered from his role in the system. And he may even be aware of that. But because he is financially successful and gets all the perks, it's very easy for him to repress that. However, they come across someone like me and they get very angry very easily. Because they know I'm right, they just can't know I'm right. This is absolutely essential in the concept of the little man and all of Sologub's work and all of the Symbolist's work. The brain, the reason in Schopenhauer is the creation of the will. In the sense that cognition is about feeding our desires. What those desires are then projected onto the world. We then go after that. And our reason is there to give us the most effective way to get it. The problem is that, especially in the modern world, once you get it, you're unsatisfied. You're never satisfied. The rich are just as happy and, in fact, less happy than the poor. My father used to say, he was a very successful businessman, funeral director, he used to say, for those who think that getting your own business means that you're your own boss, that you're an idiot. He said, when you have your own business, everybody is your boss. And what he meant was that success in that field or any field in business is misery. It could go away at any time. All it takes is one bad lawsuit, a bad article about you in the paper, and you have to repress everything that you are so as to please your target audience. How insecure it is, and the fact that it just adds a tremendous amount of responsibility. And so even getting what the world says you should get is the creation of it. And he would also say that those who are successful are less happy than those who are not. He would have sold his place, went back to being a steel worker tomorrow if he could have, but he couldn't. And this is what the Symbolists were all about. This is what Sologub's works were all about. Anyway, come to the end of my time, almost at an hour. This has been, I know this has been fairly abstract, but everything I do is fairly abstract. In terms of individual stories and plot lines, I didn't get into it. It's not really that important. But I wanted to give you the outline of what these people, if you decide a lot of this stuff is in English, believe it or not, Sologub's short stories are available for free on Google Books. You can just download the PDF. But you kind of need to know this stuff before you start reading them. And remember, they're called Symbolists for a reason. So they're referring to objects. They're not really referring to objects. Anyway, I thank my supporters. I thank those who have donated to me financially because I desperately need it. I thank my enemies and opponents because you keep us sharp. You're idiots, but you keep us sharp. Thank you very much. I'll speak to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.